note, for maximum picture quality, it may be necessary to adjust the tracking control on your VCR.
This is Adjust Your Tracking. We're a podcast where we're on an adventure to watch a century of cinema decade by decade, year by year. I am one half your host, Liam Delaney, and with me is my friend.
Hello, I'm Ollie.
He's Ol. And we're here today to just do a little roundup episode when we're going to talk about the films that we did in the 1950s, talk about the 1950s in film a little bit, and just hand out these awards that kind of, you know, it promotes conversation. That's what the awards are really for, to look behind the curtain. And to help us, as always, hand out our little Trackies awards is our friend Brandon.
That's me. I'm Brandon. I'm here to award the official best picture of the 1950s.
Yes, we're going to rewrite the record. The yep. canon. Rewrite the
this
canon.
This is written in stone. You can't change it after today.
You can't.
Nope, it's done.
And it's... the weird thing about the 1950s is, like, this selection of films we picked is difficult to do these awards with.
It's like, very... there's a lot of great stuff in here.
It's stacked.
Oh, yeah. It like really it's probably like the... we haven't watched a bad film.
No. No, we have not. There's not one that sticks out at all, actually. Even like Them, that we did as a bit kind of let's do a B movie, Them was really good.
Yeah, it was.
Like, it's a solid film.
Totally. You guys have, I think like fully half of the 10 movies are potential like best movie ever candidates, essentially.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Which is pretty ridiculous. So
which is ridiculous. I think it probably won't be like that for a lot of series. I have to say, I think it's something to do with the 1950s and maybe the amount of we've watched in the 1950s that does that. But also something, I think it's about 1950s itself. I think a lot of the kind of, you know, the AFI, the people who run like the AFI, the people that run like the Academy and stuff like that, their childhoods are all like the 1950s. So I think a lot of those films are kind of seeped into like canon, so to speak, because a lot of these people that write all the rule books and write all the canon were kind of kids when these films are coming out. And I think, like...
yeah, definitely.
I don't think it's going to be the same for the 30s, 40s, 20s. I don't think it's going to be the same, quite the same. I think the 50s just has that sweet spot. And not to say the films aren't bad. It's just, you know, narratives are written and, like, stuff like that is written by people.
Yeah, a little bit.
Their own nostalgia, like.
I think I have a theory that, generally speaking, the French New Wave is a little bit, like, overwritten about because of how important it was to baby boomer filmmakers, essentially.
Yeah.
Which is totally fair, and it's they are great and super important, but as you say, that particular generation loved that particular set of films and have sort of ignored, for example, the rest of the European New Wave that was happening right around it.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. And I guess we can fall a little bit that we might fall into a similar sort of trap in the way the films we cover. I don't know.
That's okay.
We'll see.
That's okay. But they're still great. Like, there's still definitely films you should absolutely watch.
It's never saying they're bad. And I'm not, like, we've always tried to be quite a positive kind of film podcast as well. We're not really here to kind of drag stuff.
Oh, that's
we're
too bad. I actually hated every single one of these movies.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That's why we bring you on. You're the contrary voice.
Contrast. I'm the contrast. Yeah. Every one of these films was trash. I hate them all. I'm the Armand White of this podcast.
Fucking Armand White. I love him.
he's great. I'm him now. Anyway.
Is he like genuinely serious or is he trying to be a troll? I never understand with that.
I don't know. I have no idea.
It's impossible. I think it's impossible to know.
He's a conundrum.
He's a conundrum.
So did you guys, are you guys like fully prepared? Did you already make all your picks?
I'm sorry. I just went to Armand White's Wikipedia. I do this a lot when we talk. And you know where under it goes, see also. It says, see also trolling.
There you go. Excellent.
I thought that was great.
Known for trolling.
Known for trolling.
I'm ready in as far as I've got my top to bottom 10, but I completely forgot to pick my favorite actor and actress. So I'm doing that right now.
So I'm basically in the same boat. I've figured out probably three awards, and then all the other ones I really don't know where I'm gonna go.
I don't know where I'm going on, but I have written something for everything.
I actually can't remember even all the categories we're gonna do. Maybe just throw out some random ones as we go. Fuck it.
Yeah, I think that's the best way to do it anyway. It's
Best special effects have to go to the ants in Them for sure.
To be honest, if we were doing best special effects, I think the puppets in Them are are wonderful. I think they're really great puppets. So
I'm wondering how much secret compositing might have been in like Touch of Evil or Bad and the Beautiful.
Do you reckon?
Maybe. There's definitely some good rear screen projection.
Can you hide compositing that much in the 50s?
Yeah, well, you know, absolutely you could. Citizen Kane was famous for lots of hidden compositing, actually. So.
Yeah, okay. And there's a load in, I mean, I know we're not going to talk about it today, but what was it we watched the other week? Night of the Hunter. Night of the Hunter's got loads.
Rear Window's got a great one.
Yes. It almost looked like, you know, in RoboCop when the guy falls out the window and he looks like really stretchy, like his arms stretch long. But
Yeah.
It kind of had that weird effect to it.
It did, actually. Oh, I've got an embarrassing one that I need to Google what the real name is because I can't read that out loud.
What do you mean?
One of my awards I'm giving to someone I don't know the name of.
Oh, okay. I don't know anyone's names. I don't know what we're other than like a couple of the big hitters. I don't know where we're gonna go. What's the first category? Hit me. I'm gonna just make it up as I go.
Are we gonna go round robin?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, how else could you do?
Yeah, we all just scream it at the same time. Let's do that. Let's do it that way. Hold on. You say the category, Liam, and then you go 3, 2, 1, and we all shout it.
Okay. This is not gonna work over Zoom, but
no. This...
I think first category, let's do best music. That's one I've got written down.
Oh, God. Okay. Wait, no, I don't even know. Okay, I do know. I'm ready.
Okay, I'm giving it to Rashomon. I think the music in Rashomon is gorgeous and absolutely scene placing. And there's a lot of like repeated themes in it because it's all about memory. So there's a lot of like taking the soundtrack back again. And I just thought that's really
great
cool.
Choice.
Actually, I should say who is the composer, really. Let me look that up because I think it's nice to say. I shouldn't have looked this up. Fumio Hayasaka. Fumio Hayasaka, I think.
Nice. Very good.
I'm going to go for A Touch of Evil, and that's Henry Mancini.
And, oh, cool.
Who's known for doing... I think he did the Pink Panther theme as well.
Yeah, he did.
Moon River, awesome.
Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Yeah, Mancini rules. Just quick note for me, like the 70s one we did, I took out two of my favorite films just to make it a fairer playing field and to give myself less homework. So those are Seventh Seal and Rashomon. I've seen both multiple times, and they're both 5-star classics for me, so I left them off. All the other 8 I watched or rewatched. I've seen 400 Blows, Rafifi, and Touch of Evil before, but it had been a while, so I thought I'd watch those again. All right? So that's my only variable. Best music, 400 Blows out of those 8 for me.
400 Blows.
I loved that little plaintive kind of piano, or was it a piano? I can't even remember now.
Well, it was Gene Constantine.
I don't know. Hold on. Let me. I'm
who actually? I don't think he did that many scores, did he?
Oh, really?
I don't know. Let me. I can get
Jean
there in a second.
Constantine. Ah, he looks amazing. His photo on Wikipedia. I want to be his friend.
He looks like his gym teacher from the 80s, 70s and 80s.
Isn't that Keanu Reeves, John Constantine?
Yeah, it's John. John Constantine.
He also did the music for Irreversible and Francis Ha.
Wow. The music in Francis Ha is wonderful.
Oh, no, he died in 1997. They used his music, in those films.
Oh, he did Le Vion Rose as well.
They used it again.
He does look like a gym teacher though from the 70s. That picture is incredible.
That picture is incredible. I want to share a glass of wine with him.
Yeah.
He did that many composers. Really? Yeah, you're right. He did a lot of shorts, but like it seems like those soundtracks or something is something different. I don't know how they decide what is composer and what soundtrack. Actually, I don't know how IMDb does that.
Me neither.
But it seems like a lot of his compositions then get reused in a lot of stuff.
It's weird. It's like the only real movie he did in his life was 400 Blows, it looks like.
400 Blows, yeah.
Or was this his music that he had done separately and they used it in the film, maybe?
Maybe, yeah.
I bet that's what it is, actually.
Yeah.
Anyway, I have no idea. I don't know anything. I know that I liked the music in 400 Blows, guessing. And that's the extent of my knowledge. So there you go.
I've got a bottle of kombucha because I am going full white girl today, apparently.
I don't know what that means. What's a kombucha?
It's like vinegar tea.
What?
It's really nice.
Yeah, what?
It's okay, like fermented, well, and it gives me the energy to get through the day.
Oh, I just use black coffee.
I don't like
black. That's why the 50s marathon's perfect for me, because that's all anybody drinks.
It's all drinks.
In all of these films, including the
cigarettes
children.
And black coffee.
It's just cigarettes and coffee, yeah. The 50s, that's my time. I don't.
Talking of 50s, we should go for best hat.
Oh, God.
There are loads of good hats in these films.
That's funny. That's my
wearing time period.
That was my category, and I didn't even make a pick.
What was your category?
Hold on. You go. I'm going to Google some images here and see what happens.
I think I had a couple, because it was quite good because you could actually kind of pick like cowboy hats and stuff like that as well. It wasn't just
yeah,
that.
Definitely.
But I decided that my favorite hats were in Rafifi, because I thought all of them just had the best hats, all different slights, different styles of those like gentleman hats at the time.
Those fedoras. That's what I'm looking at right now. That was my first go-to choice.
Ollie?
So I'll have to go for Orson Welles' in Touch of Evil, I guess.
Yeah.
Nice. Hold on.
Oh, I love it. I told you I watched like Touch of Evil. No, not Touch of Evil. I told you I watched Third Man yesterday, didn't I?
Yeah, like, his hat in there is glorious as well.
His whole costume, that fucking scene with the cat and him in the darkness is just the best thing on cinema. Like, it's just fucking hell.
It's definitely it's a top tier scene for sure.
Sparkle in his eye and everything. He's fucking, I love Orson. This podcast has made me feel.
I think I'm going to try and, yeah. I'm glad I turned you into an Orson Welles fanatic. I want to go with a bizarro pick here. I think, just for fun. Well, first of all, if I was including Rashomon, the woman's veil, like that giant hat she wears with the veil.
Yeah, that's a good one.
That's actually an important plot point.
Yeah, it is.
As well, would probably be my choice. But doesn't the female lead in The Man with the White Suit wear some like funny hats? Like some really interesting hats at some point?
Oh, the one who works in the factory.
Yeah, I feel like she has some like stylish little hats, and I can't.
Or do you mean the woman who her father owns the company? Which one?
I don't know which one's which. I can already barely remember that. I can't remember, and the Google image search is not giving me anything. So I'm gonna have to go with the lead in Rafifi as well, I guess. There.
Could you count
a double award for
Hood in Seventh Seal?
Yeah, that's a hat. Yeah, that's a hat.
Totally. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
That's a hat. Oh, wait, what about the little like baseball cap in The Hitchhiker?
Oh, the little
baseball sweaty little baseball caps.
Really good, yes. That's so good. And everyone has like a little kind of version of it.
Yeah.
Isn't there like, yeah, in Seventh Seal, like the actors wear funny tiny hats as well, don't they? Like funny little like skull hat things.
Yeah, little skull caps, and then one of the guys who gets kidnapped has like this kind of baseball cap that's always like falling off his head and covered in sweat.
Yeah.
Fuck it,
yeah.
I'll go with that. The baseball cap in The Hitchhiker. Yeah, let's go with that. How about best smoker next?
My best smoker is definitely Janet Leigh. Bad and the Beautiful, like that's definitely selling me cigarettes, that film.
Wait, hold on, stop. Is Janet Leigh in The Bad and the Beautiful, or is she in Touch of Evil, or is she in both?
Oh yeah, Janet Leigh is in Touch of Evil. Sorry, I'm mixing her up with the lead from Bad and the Beautiful. I was thinking of Bad and the Beautiful, but oh, who is it again?
I don't remember.
Lana Turner.
Oh yeah. Oh my. We had there's attractive women all over this marathon. I forgot all about that. Indeed. I just watched Touch of Evil last night. I just watched rewatched Touch of Evil last night, and I forgot how nice it is to look at Janet Leigh when she's in that motel in her underpants.
Yes.
That's a nice section of the movie. I'm not going to lie. Ollie, who's your best smoker? I'm not going to lie, I enjoyed that bit.
Are you going to say the little boy when he's smoking the cigar in that weird kind of collection room in 400 Blows?
That was 100%. That was my answer as well.
Yeah.
With the elephant and then the painting of, what's his name?
Napoleon?
Yeah, Napoleon. If you actually look at pictures of Napoleon, he looks like me if I've had a shave. It's really bizarre.
Oh, man. Should I be worried?
Maybe.
Okay. I love the kids smoking cigars in the weird room. I love the dad coming in and smelling it and just going, I'm going to charge you for that.
Yeah.
That's his only response, is that you owe me for 3 cigars.
You owe me.
Yeah. Big fan of that. It was potentially one of the Frenchest scenes of all time.
Oh, yeah.
All right. What's our next category?
Let's start with ensemble, because that's a nice, easy one to talk about, I think. Or good one to talk about.
A lot of good ensemble casts in this.
There's tons of really good ensemble casts, yeah.
That's tough. They're actually kind of all really good in their own ways.
So obviously, you know, you got Rashomon, the whole thing is all like an ensemble thing. Bad and the Beautiful, you got a really tight-knit ensemble.
Yeah, there's no star in that film, is there?
Not really.
Well, the one guy is pretty Mifune. Much posed on all the posters and like the DVD covers and
yeah.
stuff.
Now, Mifune's not the star of that movie. He's just
no,
the
I know,
most
but
famous
he's
actor.
The one that they used to publicize the film. Most,
that's because he was young and handsome. Jesus. you're not going to put Shimura on your fucking poster when Mifune's in there, are you?
Fifi is just an ensemble film. So what have you got? What have you got first, Al? I keep going first.
I'm gonna go for The Seventh Seal, actually.
Nice choice,
because I just think you've got quite a nice range of different characters in that film. Like, you know,
yeah,
you know, obviously you've got Death, you've got John's Squire, you've kind of who else have you got? You've got
the actors,
Max von Sydow's character,
Antonius Block.
What's his name? Oh yeah, the Block the Knight.
Yeah.
And then you've got all the actors and stuff like that. It's great.
Yeah, Joff and Maya and Jonas and the Mute Girl. And,
yeah.
Yeah. I went for Seventh Seal as well. I like it how it keeps building as an ensemble as well. You keep drawing more people into
it. Yeah, like
it
his little troops building, yeah.
Yeah, and like I can't remember the occupation. Is he the woodcutter who joins them? I love the woodcutter. Can't remember his name. He's like a carpenter, I think.
Oh, the guy with the axe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The blacksmith.
Is he a blacksmith? Okay, yeah. Ravel is his name.
Plog.
Plog. That was it. Plog.
I think it's
yeah.
Plog.
So yeah, I'm
You gotta love Plog. You gotta love Plog. He's good. Seventh Seal and Rashomon are out. Like I said, all the other ones actually are pretty good choices. But I think it's coming down to either Rafifi or 400 Blows. For me, and I'm going to go 400 Blows again, actually, because just the kids in the classroom, they're all just really compelling. I find anytime I see a movie with loads of like young actors and first-time actors or non-actors, and they're all being really realistic and they're giving good performances, I'm always totally blown away by that, frankly.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't know. As someone who has made any movies and directed any actors, I don't know how you would even like create the kind of energy on set where you could get ensemble realistic performances from children.
Well, it's like that one kid though, who kind of keeps smudging his paper and then keeps tearing them out. Like he'd be up there for like best supporting actor for me.
Oh, wow. But yeah, the it's not just that like it's well cast, which like we said, all of these movies are. The acting is actually really good in just about every film as well, frankly, but just I guess the degree of difficulty, I suppose, with that many young first time and non actors is always just amazing to me, frankly.
And first time director to actually do that as well is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, it's crazy. I guess he's
spent his whole life though, kind of just assessing films and kind of critiquing them to a point where he kind of knew kind of exactly what he wanted to say and do with his.
Sure, it's first, still no, hard it's, to put it to practice, though.
Yeah, that's still a chaotic, like, that has to be a chaotic set, right? Just practically speaking.
Oh, yeah.
And the fact that you don't, you know, that doesn't hamper the film in any way is just super impressive anyway.
not just hamper, actually, it's a benefit for the film.
Yeah, yeah, like, he makes it a benefit.
It feels
yeah, exactly.
really naturalistic and feel really great, yeah.
It's quite a thing, though. You wouldn't get a reviewer now making a film, I don't think. Like a professional.
You think we'll never get that again.
Yeah, like, well, I'm not saying you never will, but like, sure. It's very rare to kind of see that. They'll put their money where their mouth is, do you know what I mean? And kind of say,
yeah,
no, this is what I think cinema should be.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable.
I can't think of that happening too much after this point.
Yeah.
Really. And it was like a European thing, wasn't it? Of these young people in the 50s going, fuck it, I'll do it.
Yeah. And he was just so passionate and so angry at the right time, you know, like to put it into kind of work. And he wasn't, how old was he when he shot 400 Blows? He wasn't too old, was he?
No, he was pretty young. He was pretty young. Hold on,
I'll 32, so what, 30, 42. So he was in his only early 20s.
That's crazy.
It. Yeah, that is really crazy.
Very impressive. Anyway.
Mid-20s. Anyway, yeah, moving on.
Well done, Truffaut.
Well done, yeah, another hot take from us. He's good at directing.
Yep, well, Francois Truffaut gets good performances. Fucking crazy hot take.
Crazy hot take.
Never heard it.
Yeah, so how about best scene? Like best scene might be a quite a good one.
Yeah, I've got a good one. I've got. This is one of the ones I had ahead of time.
Okay, you go first then.
All right. So this is hard again. You've got classic scenes all over the place in here. More than a few. I was thinking about this earlier today. Sometimes I like to think about if you could make like a 2 or 3 minute long like montage of like the best things of movies ever to convince someone that movies are great. Right. Yeah. And you had to like boil down all of film history to those shots and moments and whatever else. It would be a pretty tough task. But frankly, like I said, about 5 of the films here would be on the short list.
Would be on it. Yeah.
Yeah. Totally. Like things like the ending of the 400 Blows, the opening of Touch of Evil, et cetera, et cetera. You can get them. For me, this is not one of those scenes that would end up in that supercut, but it's the one that maybe I thought was, I don't know, I enjoyed the most. Well, my real answer is one from Rashomon, but forget that. I love the medium in Rashomon is one of my favorite scenes. One of my favorite scenes in the history of cinema. So we're putting that aside. In The Searchers, which the ending of which is one of those scenes that 100% is going to be in that supercut.
Yes,
that's not the scene that I mean. That's you could pick that and it'd be amazing. I absolutely love the build up to and the attack on the house early on in the film. Mm-hmm. Of The Searchers. I was so impressed, but it's John Ford, so you shouldn't be. But like, I don't know why I was surprised, but when they get to the, what are they investigating? I can't even remember. Like
some dead cattle. There's some cattle. Have been
right. Okay. So John Wayne and friends leave the homestead, go find this thing. Wayne immediately understands what's happened, that it was a trick. His whole demeanor of like, we fucked this, they're already dead, there's nothing you can do, is so. Uh oh, Liam's going completely.
He's fucked up.
The podcast is over. Okay, I'll restart my fawning over The Searchers in a moment. I guess. Hold on to your horses. How are you doing, Ollie?
I'm good. You?
Why is Liam's internet so bad, Ollie?
What the hell? Sorry about that. My internet's been rubbish. Like, last thing I heard was you talking about the cattle being killed.
Okay, so I'm going to go back. I'm going to start that bit again. I'm going to rely on whichever of you is editing it to figure it out.
What do you mean, which one of us is editing it?
I don't know. Liam edited. Liam edited one of the ones I did. A good job.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, ready, Brandon, and action.
Ah, fuck. Okay. Right. Okay. So, John Wayne and friends, they go out and they find this cattle. John Wayne immediately.
No. I need more conviction from you. I'm sorry.
Fuck.
You
shut know. Up. God damn it. You've thrown off my whole vibe. I got to go back to my trailer.
John Wayne and friends.
John Wayne and friends. They find whatever the
John
fuck
Wayne
they found.
John Wayne immediately knows what's going on.
Yeah. Okay. So, stop it. Fuck. Okay. So John Wayne understands the situation. He knows immediately that it's fucked, that the people back at the homestead are already dead. There's no point. He doesn't care. His reaction is so surprising. Not at all what I expected. It's so grim. It's so like upsetting. And the other right. guys are all trying to be the hero. They're all trying to be like, we can do it. We can rush back. And he's like, no, you can't. Just don't even try. And
there's
it's
no heroism here.
No. And it's so intense. And the second that happens, the way that it's presented and played, like you, the audience, know he's right. Like yeah. it's, there's no question that he's right. And the intensity of that, like the, what's the term for it? The, like the dramatic irony or whatever it is of okay. how like the audience knows what's going to happen now. And then instead of, cutting to them finding it, later, he does make the choice to cut back to the homestead from the point of view that are of the people that are still there before the attack and show you the whole thing. Like, yeah. even though yeah. you already know what's going to happen. And the intensity of that was off the fucking chart for me. I was like nails into the chair. I knew approximately what was going to happen. I knew I hadn't seen the film before, but I knew the approximate story, but it still yeah. was just that well put together. Again, shocking. It's John Ford. That I was just like butt clenched, sweating at the worried about this family. I didn't know which of them were going to live, which of them were going to die. I knew the little girl was going to make it out, but I didn't know how bad it was going to get. So I guess that was the tension for me. And the way he built it up, it was just as you said during your episode, Liam, a master at work, frankly. And it was just so exciting for me to finally see, John Ford just knock a scene like that completely out of the fucking stratosphere.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway.
And I didn't know exactly what the story was. I don't tend to read too much into it. I kind of just go in a little bit blind, and I didn't particularly know, like, the title itself, The Searchers, hadn't done any thinking about what that title actually meant. So I went in there and I didn't know it was going to be this from the start. I didn't know there was going to be a big, like, you know, capture scene and whatever. So it surprised me. Yeah, that's a good pick, Brandon.
Thank you. It's a better movie, better scene.
I think mine. I don't know if this is a bit of a boring choice, but I think it's just really influential, and that's just the whole heist scene in Rafifi. Really, I mean, it's just so right. well executed, and it's just so perfectly done that, like, pretty much every heist film since then has pretty much copied it beat for beat, pretty much, hasn't it? Really.
It pretty much set the kind of standard of yeah. what you expect from heist films, and what even the genre was as a heist, you know, like this. And, you I know, guess like, that people had robbed banks before, but a heist film is different. Like, and it almost set that kind of table out.
Yeah, and it's like 30 minutes maybe of just no dialogue or nothing, just kind yeah. of just sound effects and that, and it's just so well done.
Just that delight of watching experts work, you know.
Yeah, that was my second choice, obviously.
I think my choice is more boring.
Oh no!
Because my choice is definitely the opening of Touch of Evil. It just yeah. I still think about that opening, and it was just like not just how like masterful it's shot, the context around it as well. Like, I think about the way Orson Welles said in his memo that if you put credits over a scene, it drops attention out of it. I think about that constantly, and almost every film I've watched since then, I notice what the credits are over. You know, I notice if there's, you know, if it's not an intro, like, you know, a Fincher kind of intro, if it's just dropping credits over, like, stuff happening, I think about what they're dropping it over.
But it makes you feel like all I'm watching a film now is I'm not immersed in the story as much, I guess, maybe. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's that comfortableness. You're not quite into it yet. You're just getting like lowered into the chamber, you know, like lowered into the chamber. I was thinking of diving for some reason. But like, yeah, you're not quite immersed yet. You're just getting kind of like just settling in.
And also, what was his like reasoning that you think, oh, because I've got credits over this, you think the characters are going to be safe and that straight away, whereas yeah. he didn't want them to be like in a safe environment straight away. You wanted to be a bit kind of...
Yeah, he wants to introduce this ticking bomb, and you knew that it was going to go off, and you knew people were going to get harmed by it. He wanted that to be a thing, and if you put credits over it, it mutes that tension, because that bomb could have gone off anywhere on that high street, you know, anywhere that car was going. I didn't know when it was going to go off. I didn't know it was going to go off actually when, like, the cop, you know, the border patrol agent was there and stuff. I just thought it worked so well, and I can't stop thinking about it. And not just the technical aspects of like how to shoot that on a crane in one shot. I think that's absolutely amazing. But even just like the context around of why that scene was there, why it was shot the way it was, why it was composed the way it was without credits and stuff.
The sound design's amazing in that shot as well. Like, yeah, how you've got the sounds coming from all the different sides, from the different, because it's kind of got that conflicting music, hasn't it, within the film, hasn't it? Kind of like.
Yes, yeah, so you got the music from all like the kind of go-go bars or whatever they were in the 50s, like, and all the kind of music pumping out from them that changes as you move down the high street to like different street sounds and you know, rabble and people's voices and things. Yeah, like I think that was just, that's just masterful filmmaking. And that's as Brandon was saying, it's one of the, you know, it's one of the scenes that you pick for like, this is what cinema is, obviously.
And then it ends with our friend, what's his name, in brownface?
Charlton Heston in brownface.
Come on now.
You know what? It's the film's in black and white, so you don't really notice it that much. If the film was in... If the film was in color...
He's the least Mexican man ever. Like, at least he didn't put an accent on and stuff.
He did try to speak Spanish in a couple of scenes, which was hilarious. And I love how they always cut around. Like, they'd have him say two or three words that he could do. And Heston was game. Like, he gave it a try. But it would be like, oh, he's on the phone in the background going like, sí, señora, and then move his hand, you know, over his mouth and sort of mumble some shit.
Well, what I find crazy is that when he was cast in the film, he was meant to be an American guy, wasn't it? So obviously somewhere along the lines, it changed to a Mexican character.
His mustache and suit game is fucking amazing.
It was.
He looks incredible. I was like, I want to. And then he has, at a certain point, the big shades, the sick suit, and the wicked mustache. And I was like, man, that's who I want to be.
And it's just that kind of, I mean, I never thought too much about Charlton, but his kind of way of holding in all that tension, all that film, until it just explodes in that bar when he gets really angry. It was just really
when he's picking
good.
People up, like the Incredible Hulk.
Yeah, and he's just chucking this bar around and like throwing people around.
He was awesome. A big and athletic man.
Yeah, huge guy.
Yeah. I disagree with the Chuck Heston hate. I mean, he's a dickhead of a human being, but I actually love
him. I think he's good in the film. Don't get me wrong.
I love his star presence. I love him in Planet of the Apes. I love him in this. I love him in Ben-Hur.
I love him in Planet.
He's great. I love him. Anyway, yeah, that opening scene's incredible. Oh, it's starting on the close-up of the timer is just such a classic, just perfect, so like, get you right in, kick you, like, slap you right across the face opening frame. It's amazing.
I tell you as well, like, I was thinking of when you're talking about him being brownface as well. Do you remember Bad and the Beautiful, the Mexican actor as well? Gilbert Roland, that just looked him up. They definitely made Charlton Heston to look like him. Like, there's someone out there going, this guy's a really famous Mexican actor, make Charlton look a bit like that.
Right.
Like, you got the hair and the kind of mustache and everything like that. It's almost like to the point of you could have just cast Gilbert Roland.
Marlena Dietrich also supposed to be Mexican?
Oh God, I don't think so.
I think she was.
Well, yeah, but you forget
it.
Didn't
occur to me.
They couldn't cast anyone else because the whole funding of the film was on Charlton Heston, wasn't it? So because
the
film was made.
He was absolutely attached to it.
But Dietrich, obviously she's blonde famously in real life, and she's wearing a black wig to play the part. I think she's supposed to be Mexican, which is crazy.
You know, if I'm very honest, I just kind of thought she was like one of those Germans that ended up in South America for a reason.
Because that could be. Yeah, she's a fled Nazi. That's fine. Let's go with that.
I didn't put it that way.
Yeah, sure you did. No, she was amazing too. I love her.
She was. And what a star power to put at the end of that film. Well,
anyway,
she was in the star as well.
Anyway, that's enough about Touch of Evil. What's our next category?
Let's do Best Actress. Or should we do Best Supporting Actress first?
Oh my God. Okay.
We're going to find this with the 50s. It's quite difficult to pull out, I think, supporting actress.
Yeah, you're going to have to remind me who's who.
But I'll say my one, though. This might be, some of the actors might be category fraud, but I don't think anyone's going to pull me up on it. But okay. I went for Claire Maurier, who plays the mom in 400 Blows.
Are you calling her supporting?
Yeah, I guess it's kind of a, she's like lead,
well, she's the
really,
lead female, isn't she?
Yeah.
No, you're right. She's a supporting. No, she's a supporting character, though.
But I think the character is supporting to the plot, even though she's like the lead actress. She's the character role was kind of supporting, so that's why I went for that.
I think that's fair. What about you, Ollie?
Come back to me in a second. You go first.
Okay. Oh no! Wait. The silly hats. Sorry, it wasn't Man in the White Suit. It was the lady in them. It was the scientist in them. She had silly hats. I'm going back to my hats answer. The lady in them.
<He's retconning. laughs>
There, I fucking erased that bit. And she has this funny little white skull cap that was very stylish and cool. And I thought it was very 50s and I liked it a lot. Anyway, 100% agree with Liam. Best supporting actress, the mom in Foreigner Blows. I loved her character and her performance. I kind of wish there was a bit more of the family dynamic and a bit less shitty teachers. Because I thought the up and down of the drama with the family was so strong and so compelling. The sometimes you're sympathetic to the parents, sometimes you hate them. You go back and forth. They're imperfect, but sometimes they're trying, and they kind of give up. And I don't know. It was they're both really good.
I just thought Claire Maurier, she plays that how did you just word it? She plays that kind of. Infallibility, that kind of that
imperfection,
that mixed nature imperfection, thank you. She plays that imperfection of her character so well.
It makes you
kind of just really sympathize for her. She feels incredibly real. She doesn't feel like she's written as this character to be imperfect. She feels like just a real good example of just a woman in the 1950s trying to get a win out of life, really.
Yeah, exactly. 100%. Yeah, it's like you sort of, like, by the end of the movie, you very much disagree with her choices, but at the same time, you do sympathize with this, with her scenario, because of, like, I don't know, there's the empathy in her eyes.
Scenario. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
she does a lot with a little screen time, actually.
Yeah.
So she's great. Also, I think the lady, the much maligned lady in Rafifi, who gets treated like shit by everybody, she was really good too. But it's not as juicy of a part, is it? So,
Ollie, have you decided yet?
I'm trying to think of. Well, sadly, I can't pick anyone from Night of the Hunter or Rear Window.
No,
which is who I would have picked from if I could have.
Well, you can call. Well, hold on. Hold on, you can call the wife in Rashomon a supporting role because there's no lead roles in the film.
I was going to pick, and I can't think of her name, my mind's gone completely dead, but the woman who worked in the factory in Man in the White
Suit.
She's
wonderful.
She's really funny, I agree. Yeah, she's really
good.
I'm trying
to think of her. It's not Joan Greenwood, is it? It's not that one. It's
No, it's not Joan Greenwood. She's the she's the daughter.
Is it Bertha, Vida
Hope? Industrialist. It is Bertha.
Yeah, Vida Hope. There Bertha. You go. Vida Hope, whatever.
She's really good in that. And
she's
I
super
found
fun. Her
really funny. And I really wanted to be her friend. Like, I wanted to go for beers with her, you know.
I agree.
She
was
yelling at me about communism or whatever. Like,
she was really funny. I 100%. That's a great choice. Great choice.
That is a great choice, yeah.
All right. What's
so best supporting actor then?
Supporting actor. Yeah. All right.
Okay.
Lots of choices on this one.
Yep.
Okay. Wait, I think this is one of the ones I chose, or I had an idea on as well. So you could go with the villain in The Hitchhiker. He's really good. You could go with, I don't know, like 90 different performances in Foreigner Blows or Rafifi, I guess. But for me, it came down to basically two wholesome nice guys, because there's so many dickheads in this, out of these films. So it came down to the very nice agent in The Bad and the Beautiful and the very nice Italian guy in Rafifi. Those were the two that I'm picking before. And I think I'm going to go with the nice Italian guy in Rafifi. So he's one of the thieves, the first Italian guy. I don't remember which one's which.
The director?
Yeah.
No.
Not the safe cracker, the other one.
Not Desan, no.
Mario.
I think it's, I think I mean Mario.
With his,
and the
actor
is
his wife.
The guy with the nice wife. It's Robert Manuel playing Mario Ferrati.
Is it Tony? No. I know Tony's the other guy. He's the older guy, isn't he?
Tony's the complete dickhead.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Tony LaStefanois.
I'm finding it hard trying to remember some of these because it's been about 6 months since
we watched. We've been doing this forever. I had the same trouble.
Mario's really good because I like when he gets on the money and he's like, me and my wife, we're just going to have sex all over Paris. <That's our plan.
laughs> Yeah, it's like, this is that's a great guy. I like him.
I like Mario, yeah.
He was really funny. He's another like a performance that, again, you know, he doesn't have a huge dramatic arc. He doesn't necessarily have as much screen time, but I think even Paul mentioned it in your episode. Like, you understand this dude's essence the second you see him.
Yeah,
absolutely. Like, and that's just really, absolutely. I don't know. I always love it when an actor can pull that off. Ollie, you got to do it. Let's go, Ollie.
What's this? I'm trying to think. I'm going to go for, I don't know. I'm thinking Plog, just because he amused me the most, the blacksmith.
Plog is so good. Plog's one of my favorite characters in film history. Like, I love Plog. I love him getting so sad.
He just reminded me of like someone like Obelix or whatever, just walking, yeah, just like bouncing around.
William, what was your choice?
Mine's a bit. One of the people I did think of, but I don't want to give him the award because I don't like it. But was, I think, Henry Brandon playing Scar in the Searchers is really good performance.
Yeah,
I think it's crappy because he's playing a Native American and he's German, like, right. So but I think the choice to cast him and him to play it in a way that's so sympathetic, actually, and he isn't playing he's playing as like a hard man, but he's actually playing as like a learned and quite like and quite sympathetic way that it actually twists that kind of narrative of who he is. Like, he's very much the equal of like John Wayne in it.
Yeah, they're meant to be like mirror characters, aren't they?
Like mirror characters, yeah. And I just thought that was a really good, just a really good presence and a really good way to drop into the film as well at the point that he's dropped into it, which is quite later as well.
Yeah, I love the way that character is portrayed on the page, but like the fact that it's a German guy is so upsetting, I can't deal with it.
It's so upsetting, exactly.
Yeah, it doesn't, and it bothers me way more than Chuck Heston in Touch of Evil, and I actually am not even 100% sure why.
Same.
Yeah. What about same. Absolutely, I mean, you've same. Also got the nephew, well, he's not nephew, but you know, like, is it Martin's character?
Captain Pike.
Yeah, Captain Geoffrey Hunt. Yeah.
Is it the young, like, good-looking guy that John Wayne hates because he's half Native or whatever?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
His performance is okay. I wouldn't put him up there with everyone.
I love the Mexican cop guy, you know, I think he was amazing.
In The Searchers?
Yeah.
I don't even remember that bit.
He meets him in just, like a bar, just, doesn't he? Where they
you've
like,
literally just Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Oh, in the bar. Oh right, oh right, point. Yeah.
I was thinking about giving it to Bengt Ergot playing Death. I think Death is a supporting character in that. He's not a main.
I mean, it's iconic, isn't it? Go for it.
Like, but yeah, it's an absolute just a performance that like survives time. I don't know how do you word it. It's eternal. It's an eternal performance.
Yeah,
it's, you know,
that's a good choice actually.
So yeah. Bengt Ergot, that's who I actually went for. But I wanted to shout out the complicatedness of this search. It's like,
yeah, definitely. I suppose
for best supporting actress, you could have picked the like the witch or whatever in Rashomon.
Oh yeah, well that's 100%. Yeah. That's the actual choice. Yeah. That's the real choice.
That's the real choice.
I'll still stick
let's
with
do,
Midgar.
Let's do cinematography then.
Wait, did we do lead? Are we doing lead performances later?
Yeah, let's come back to lead.
Okay, all right. Okay, cool. Cinematography. All right, go ahead.
Because almost every one of the films we watched was black and white, I think. One of them was colour?
Searchers is the only colour one.
Searchers the only colour?
That can't be. No, is that right? That's crazy. Yeah. No, Them is colour, isn't it?
Nope.
What?
I don't think it is.
Them is black and white.
How the fuck did you do a whole 50s marathon with one colour film?
Well, we did cover some colour films, but not in the main bulk.
That's crazy. Yeah. Why I didn't? I don't know why that didn't even occur to me. Well done.
I was going to say, like, because of that, a lot of the shooting in this is kind of noirish. A lot of it's kind of playing with shadows, a lot of playing with like harsh blacks and stuff like that. So the cinematography is all, I want to say the cinematography is all quite similar in that way, but I don't mean to say they're all just the same.
Just because like, they're black and white.
I just mean they're of a piece, you know? Yeah. Apart from The Searchers, which is doing a very different thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the film noir look was so popular
It was specific. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
you
couldn't specific, you couldn't really get away yeah. from it. And it's sort of what am I looking for? What's the word I'm looking for? Oh my God! It's because of the technology of the time looked good in noir lighting, essentially. So the film stock that you have, the lenses that you have, and the lights that you have, and the fact that everybody's smoking all the time leads it
helps so much.
It basically means that film noir is what you want to do, if you see what I mean. Yeah. Like the you don't have soft lights; they don't exist, essentially. So you only have really hard lights as a light source. That black and white stock and those lenses react to that hard light in a way that is pleasing if you do it in a film noir style. So it's sort of like in the context of the technology they had, of course you're going to film stuff in a noir way. It just totally makes sense.
Yeah.
There you go.
And saying that, my cinematography is going to Gunnar Fleischer for Seventh Seal.
Nice.
That is a film that is literally just made for images on students' walls. I don't know. Like it's made for postcards. You know, it's made for like
just, it's gorgeous.
That
it's,
kind of look.
Like. It's so gorgeous. Yeah, can't disagree. I'm looking up who mine is now.
See, I'd love to go for Rashomon, but the problem is, I think the print of Rashomon is pretty fucked. Now, like, I haven't seen. I tried to look for like a different version of Rashomon to watch, but I assume there's only one print that I've ever like mastered onto Blu-ray or whatever, and so it kind of looks a bit washed out. So it's hard for me to kind of really judge it. But I'm going to pick Touch of Evil.
Great choice.
Great choice. And that's Russell Mette.
So they're all great. You have like six films that are easily like top tier, as good as cinematography gets. So you can't really go too wrong.
You can't go wrong.
No. With Rashomon, it's interesting because I think you're right. I think it's never been remastered to the level of some of these other films. I know I've seen it projected on film at least once and maybe twice. And so maybe that's why I like it so much, because I've seen it, you know, and in the best way that you can. So I don't know.
Do you know what I mean? It does look quite washed out.
No, you're right. Yeah. No, you're right. Every time I go back, because I do try and show quite a few of these films come up in the classes that I teach, and Rashomon comes up from time to time. But like, I almost don't want to show it to them because it's tough to find clips of it that actually look as good as you think it should look, essentially. So yeah, you're not wrong. Anyway, so this was a tough, actually, this in a lot of ways, this was less of a tough choice than I thought it was going to be, as much as all of your choices are correct. I'm going with The Searchers again, shot by Winton C. Hawk. I don't know this man. he also did The Quiet Man and She Wore a Yellow Ribbon. So did John Ford's movies from this time period, looks like.
Yeah.
And it's the film is famous for what it looks like. It's got one of the most famous last shots in cinema history for a reason. It's not just the color is gorgeous. I love the color from this time period, the black and white of these other films.
So textured, isn't it?
It's so textured. It's so warm. It's amazing. Yeah. Obviously, a lot is made about them going out to Monument Valley to film, which, as you pointed out, is not in Texas. And on top of that, was never Comanche country. And on top of that, no one ever, as far as I know, built any homes there, because it's like hostile territory. Like, you would never live there. That's crazy. Like,
watching the making of that film is nuts. It's like, because obviously to do a lot of those tracking shots of the horse and that, they had to build roads.
Right.
Sure.
To drive the cars and put the dolly tracks on and stuff like that. So they built a whole like little town just to be able to film the film.
Yeah, of course. So you can read that a lot of ink has been spilled about, you know, John Ford's mythic lensing of the American landscape. And quite correctly, before this point, I'd only seen Stagecoach, I think, is the only John Ford movie I've seen. So it was really nice to agree with everybody that anyone can go out to Monument Valley and take some nice pictures, but not like this. And I don't know. I don't even know what to say about it. I know I've said before, like, Kurosawa is one of my all-time favorite filmmakers. Rashomon's one of my all-time favorite films. Kurosawa's favorite filmmaker was John Ford. and he said it all the time. And watching this, the way that Ford frames the characters in space and the action, I could see the influence on Kurosawa pretty clearly. They both have a similar way of framing their characters in space that I am just a slut for, is the simple answer. So I just enjoyed the absolute shit out of that, really.
Him shooting the action, like throwing that camera through those horses when they're riding and stuff like that, it was just astonishing.
Yeah, it's just electric stuff. It's poetic and intense, conflicted. I feel like the thematic content of the film, which you guys got into about John Ford's conflicted soul, is baked into the images in a way like the Seventh Seal.
Yeah,
that I just found really moving, actually. There you go.
So we move on to best screenplay then.
That's wow. Oh, there's a screenplay one? Oh, fuck.
Yeah. Okay. I don't tend to do adapted and whatever. I just best screenplay.
Best writing. Best writing. All right.
Yeah, best writing. Yeah. I'll do mine because I might drop that on you guys. But my one is Rashomon.
Yeah.
Because there's such... I mean, it invented a type of screenplay.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's... Like loads of things are good about that film. Loads of things are good about that film. But I think the screenplay is the masterful bit for me. I think it's what pulls everything together. And without that screenplay, the way it's written, without kind of thinking about how to tell this story in this exact way and not the ways it could have been told, and actually make that theme of memory, like the running through that screenplay, I think is just wonderful. Just absolutely wonderful.
It's amazing. I'll go next, I guess. I love that choice, obviously. Great choice. This is I didn't even think about this at all. I would say that taking out Rashomon and Seventh Seal, all the other ones have a lot of pros and a lot of like and other bits that I didn't like as much. So pretty much every film has some section of it where I was a little bit disengaged or thought you didn't have to show this part or, you know, whatever it is. So I don't know. I think this is tough. So I actually kind of like The Bad and the Beautiful, but it does go on forever. So I think I'm going to go with 400 Blows again, actually. I think he's telling the story of his own life. I think he does it rather well. You said, like you said in your episodes, episodic, but, within those episodes, you do get, like we talked about a minute ago with the mother character, a lot of nuance in all the characters, with the exception of the teachers and the cops who are uniformly comedically terrible. But the parents and the children, it's just quite a bit going on with all of those characters that is just really compelling and really natural and to watch. I don't know. It was nice.
Yeah.
There you go.
Good choice.
I'll probably go for Rashomon as well, but I just wanted to point out The Hitchhiker as well. I thought that was quite a nice tight screenplay as well. It's very short and to the point. You know me, I like my short films.
It's really good.
But I thought it was really, really well done, that film as well. So, I mean, I wanted to say Rashomon just because, like Liam said, it's like, you know, it created a whole, not a genre, but like a way of telling stories that's been made so many times.
Yeah, it was so innovative, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But I just wanted to point out The Hitchhiker. I thought that was I agree. Especially because it was so soon after the event as well. And I think, you know, Ida Lupino also wrote the screenplay as well with Colin Young.
She did, yeah.
And she actually went to interview the people who were involved as well. So
yeah.
And I think, you know.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the fact that the whole thing was basically those three characters and sort of like the power dynamics between the three of them is really what powers the whole movie, and that's not easy to do. Like, that could get flat really fast, and they wrote it really well. So yeah, I agree.
Yeah,
good choice.
I agree.
Good second choice.
Let's do the best actress then. Let's go to that one.
Wow. All right. You go.
Mine's Janet Leigh.
Oh yeah,
Touch of Evil.
She's great
because she looks so good in that hotel room. With Brandon pointed out,
it was difficult to I had to calm myself down. I was like, I'm getting weird now. This is getting weird. I need to relax.
she's just got so much energy in that film, and so, and like to work alongside, at especially at the beginning, alongside Charlton, and to actually be so big and be so kind of powerful at that start, you know, to wanting to go along with this investigation, not to just be the coward and stuff like that. Obviously that's in the script, but she shares that screen with Charlton, who is so big and such a big presence on screen, and she shares that screen with Orson fucking Welles. And she keeps her own to the point that you remember all the way through, and you kind of follow her. I think she was such a good lead
before. Yeah, she's really good. I'd forgotten what her character was all about, and yeah, she is sort of like really energetic and weird in a way that you're not really expecting her to be.
Yeah.
She kind of never reacts. Because she never reacts how you expect her to react.
No. Yeah. Not at all. And it's important because they're going to separate them. She's going to be on her own for a lot. And actually she's going to be like a bit of a tug for the rest of the screenplay. And she manages to keep that up, you know, that you don't forget her. She doesn't get forgotten in the kind of film.
Good stuff. Okay. I'll have one. I'll give Ollie a second. So Janet Leigh's great. Lana Turner from Bad and Beautiful is the other big choice, and I'm going to go with her. We watched that, it feels like 4 years ago at this point. So I don't remember a ton of detail, but I do remember liking her performance. She's very important to the film, has a lot to do. It was her versus Kirk Douglas kind of all over the map. She has to play a pretty big age range. She has to play quite a lot of dramatic scenes. I just remember thinking she was really good. But yeah, I can't like, be specific about
kind of screen presence and stuff like that, doesn't she? Like,
so. Yeah. Oh, she has to. Oh no! Wait. You know what she does? Actually, I do remember. I do have a specific to point out. She has to, because she's obviously a very good actress, and at some point she has to play like a not good actress.
Yeah.
On screen, yeah. And that's another thing I always find really impressive, when good actors pretend to be bad actors, and they can nail that energy. It's just super impressive to me. Okay, Ollie. Now Ollie? You go.
So I think my real answer is Lana Turner. But I did like Joan Weldon as Dr. Pat Medford in Them, because she's pretty badass. Cool. She like, you know, she goes on all the, you know, she gets stuck in on that film.
Yeah,
she's fun. Yeah, she's fun. She doesn't take no shit from nobody.
Exactly. Yeah,
she's like a throwback to the Hepburns of the 40s.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. She is. Yeah.
Which is nice to see, because once you get into the 50s, you get to sort of like the, well, all the boys are back from the war now, so you can go fuck off, ladies. energy that becomes a problem for the next 40 years in American film. Anyway.
Marilyn's come on in. Yeah. Go on, let's do actor then.
Okay. We have a lot more choices. We have a lot more choices on that one, don't we? I don't know mine. You go.
I want to give it to someone, and you're going to tell me that he's not the lead. Because I want to give it to Mifune. And you're going to tell me there's no lead in that film.
Listen, you can give Mifune any fucking award you want whenever you want. He's the best.
My kind of pick of, I really want to give it to Mifune. I think he's remarkable in Rashomon.
He's like, great in every movie.
Yeah, he is. He is an absolute legend. Like, and the fact that Rashomon is just a film that asks you to perform the same scenes in different ways, I think he's just remarkable at that. And brings a different energy to each time. And I just think, yeah, Mifune is really good. My other choice was, and again, I'm not actually sure he counts as leading, might actually count as supporting, was Orson, because I think that, I guess he's kind of lead.
Yeah, I call him the lead.
Orson is just so despicable in terms of evil and so horrid and just so like greasy and so like, you know, like, like wet and smoky, you can smell him almost.
Yeah,
on screen.
So
like,
I guess I'll build off you, and I think I'm going with Orson Welles as well. But it's down to him and Jean-Pierre Léaud from 400 Blows, the kid.
Sure,
I think they're both fantastic in what they're doing. They're both completely different. And for funzos, I'm going to give it to Orson Welles because he's just so gross. Okay.
I'm going to go for Jean-Pierre Léaud. I can't say it in the French.
Léaud.
Just, I thought he was just came across very honest and very realistic. But I also want to shout out Max von Sydow, because he looks like a Mike Mignola, like, comic panel come to life.
I was going to say that about bloody the cinematography, that it looks like wood carving, and Max von Sydow looks like a bloody like wood carving of like a, you know, as you say, like Hellboy kind of style.
He like, does look like, you know, the way his the way his cheekbones are defined, just the way the shadows cast on his face, they look very angular. So
yeah, you're right. Absolutely good pick. Absolutely right.
I'm gonna give another like second place shout out to the two guys in The Hitchhiker who I think were also really good.
Yeah, they were really good. Yeah,
yeah.
I
real interesting the dynamic shift between the two of them as well.
Yeah, definitely. Which I liked. Yeah.
Shall we go do director then?
Oh God. Okay. This is a tough one.
This is incredibly tough. My, I'll go first because I'm happy to go first. My one is Francois Truffaut.
Yeah.
What a film! One, two, invented new wave with it. So you know, arguably, invented new wave with it. So
well, Agnes Varda would like to have a word.
Yeah, I know, but that, she didn't. Her film didn't get released till after. That's where the argument, isn't it?
No, didn't she have one before that? She did.
Yeah, the film that came before Thunder Blows, it never got a cinema release because she's a lady.
Fuck that. Yes, no, it did. fucking, what's it called? I can't even. I haven't even seen it, so maybe it's garbage. I don't know. So who knows? What's
I know the film about. I can't remember what it's called.
Hold on, I'm finding out. La Pointe Courte. Yeah, came out in 1955. Right.
Yeah, but it didn't get released then. I swear it didn't.
Well, Truffaut definitely saw it.
I swear it didn't. Well, yeah, that's different. Anyway, it's not. Anyway, I'm not trying to downplay Varda. Varda is amazing, and that and everything else like that. I just Truffaut.
Yeah.
Doing this film and everything is just wonderful, and the way he kind of plays with that memory of his own childhood, but actually sets it in the 50s. The way he uses shots of Paris from different points of view, like childhood point of views and stuff like that. I love the scene, the way he shoots the scene in the whatever the gravitron or whatever it's called.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Of people just losing their minds.
Was that also an elevator to the gallows? That same thing.
It might have been.
Or Rafifi. I feel like it was one of the other French movies had the same fucking scene.
Maybe it was just a big in Paris at the time. That these things were always there. Maybe
it must have been a huge hit.
Yeah.
Answer. Anyway. Same answer for me. I'm going to go with Truffaut for the reasons you just said, and mainly for the, frankly, that ensemble cast thing I was talking about earlier is the main reason I'm going to give it to him. All the performances were great. That's director's primary job. And these were people that, you know, wouldn't give good performances for a normal, your everyday average director. It just wasn't going to happen. So I find that award worthy. Good work, Francois.
I'm going to go for Jules Dassin for Rafifi. And I think, hey.
Get the fuck out.
He was best director in the Cannes Film Festival that year as well. So
get the double fuck out. What year was that? I guess no other good movies came out that year. Get the fuck out of here.
I'm confused.
Have you got against the sun?
Well, fucking Night of the Hunter came out that year.
Night of the Hunter, can I?
Came out that year. God damn it. The fuck out of here.
But no, I thought, I think that film works like clockwork. And I think
Rafifi's really good. It's
perfectly so.
Yeah. I agree with you. It's really good. I'm just being a dickhead. It's really good. Like you said, the heist scene's one of the best like action scenes of all time, easily. And then I always forget how good everything after that is as well. And just how like grim and intense and it just gets everything like spirals out of control in a way that's really intense, but also kind of fun to watch. So yeah, great stuff.
Oh, that's funny. Actually, when I think of that film, what I think about is all the stuff around the kind of half built house at the end.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And that's really kind of sunk into my memory. And I never thought there was almost anything after like kind of the robbery.
It's still the wrong answer, but fair enough.
What should my right answer be then?
Kurosawa, obviously. Jesus. Sorry. No, Dassin, for sure. He's great.
I guess we should do our top 10 countdown. I just wanted to do one shout out because we there's been a lot of cops in our films.
Oh, yeah.
And I just wanted to give a shout out to the best cop. Is the Mexican cop in The Hitchhiker.
100%. 100%. That's a great answer. Same answer. Love that guy.
FBI agent.
Yeah, the great Mexican cop in The Hitchhiker, or the great Mexican cop in The Searchers, right?
Yeah.
Is that a Mexican cop or just a regular? I can't remember.
Whatever. If Mexican, I can't even find out who the actor was in The Hitchhiker. It's very confusing to me. Is it Taylor Flanagan?
Let's have a look. I agree. I think he's great. Best cop, 100%. What the hell? Does this movie not exist? Oh, there's a hyphen. That's the problem. Who knows? I'm going to say it's Jose Torve.
Maybe. It might be Jean Delval. It might be Jean Delval. I think it might be him playing the Mexican.
Who knows? Cop about. Ollie, who's your favorite cop?
My favorite cop?
Other than Orson Welles, obviously.
Oh, yeah, I forgot. his partner, I don't know.
Yeah, his partner's great at the end where he has to, where he kills him. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Good choice.
Right, let's do our countdown then. Top 10.
You go first.
So, do we do this just one by one, or
no?
Just do it
all in one go.
Okay, this is really difficult, and there's literally like five of these that are basically the same ratings.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, like to rank them is just so hard.
It's a waste of time, really.
So, but yeah, the top three I can't. I literally don't know what my top three is. That's the thing. So, Man in the White Suit, I got last. There's nothing against it. I thought it was a great film. It's just, it doesn't hold a candle to some of the others.
No, it's like a different them, flavor, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, Them, wonderful horror film. I loved it so much. I then dropped The Searchers, the next one. And that's quite low on my rank, because I don't know why I put it so low on this list. But I think it's just like, I had so much difficulty enjoying that film, despite the fact that it's so like well shot and so masterful. So that's probably why it got there. Then I got Hitchhiker, brilliant, like, kind of intense noir. Bad and the Beautiful, like, a really good cast of characters in the story about Hollywood. Then I got Rafifi. Then Seventh Seal. Then Rashomon. Touch of Evil, 400 Blows. I got 400 Blows.
Yeah, trying to pick between those top three is so hard.
It's so hard. It could be the other way around completely. Yeah, for sure. Different day.
Yeah, fair enough. I'll go. Ollie can go last because he's the co-host and I'm just a guest. All right. So did you say Seventh Seal? Where was that?
Seventh Seal was fourth.
Okay. So Seventh Seal and Rashomon. Rashomon's one, Seventh Seal two probably, but I didn't rewatch them, so throw those out. Them in last place, followed by Man in White Suit. Same thing you said, they're both fine, but they're not masterpieces, and basically everything else is close to it or is. After that, kind of a tie between Hitchhiker and Bad and the Beautiful. No, I'll go Hitchhiker and then Bad and the Beautiful. I like the cinematography too much. Then Rafifi, then Touch of Evil, then 400 Blows, and I'm going to say controversially, The Searchers is my favorite film.
Sweet.
My favorite movie was The Searchers. There's not enough time to go into why it's wildly problematic. I don't disagree one bit. Obviously there's parts of it that are grotesque. There's parts of it that aren't as good as other parts, as you guys talked about, in your episode. Apparently that's a common, like even the biggest John Ford fans in the world, say the same. I don't have as much of a problem with like cheesy 50s acting as you guys did.
Okay.
I don't know why. Maybe I'm just like more, I don't know, used to it or something, but that's like, that's just how people acted in Hollywood movies at the time. So it just kind of, I don't know, it didn't really put me off.
Well, but yeah, you could say that, but I think a lot of the films we watched around this time, people didn't as well. So it's,
well, that's
why I felt that a lot of people were matching kind of, because they cast John Wayne as the lead, they kind of had to cast around that, didn't they? So they felt like they picked actors that kind of...
Yeah, no, that's fair. I mean, the only two like fully Hollywood movies you watched in this marathon were The Searchers and Bad and the Beautiful. And they both have like cheesy theatrical acting all over them. That was the style at the time. It's not my favorite acting style ever. But I guess I'm just more forgiving. I don't know. But it's problematic in a way that I just find incredibly compelling, and poetic and troubling and difficult.
Yeah,
I found it intoxicating.
I think it's designed problematic as well, as you say. I think there's a lot of intentionality behind that.
I agree. Well, I mean, basically a three-way tie between that, Touch of Evil, and 400 Blows. Don't get me wrong.
Sure.
But I could not stop thinking about the Searchers after I watched it. Like, I couldn't stop thinking about, like, do I hate this character? How much do I hate this character? Do I hate John Ford? Or do I love John? I don't know. I don't know how I feel about any of this. But, like, in a way
I remember me and Ollie delayed our recording, at least... I delayed it because I was like, I'm not ready to talk about this. You need to give me more time. I can't make my mind up about stuff.
Yeah, so. For sure. And I don't know. I guess maybe I'm at the age where I prefer to watch stuff that I definitely fundamentally don't agree with, confuse the shit out of me. I guess. I don't know. There you go. The Searchers. Best movie of the 50s ever. The end. except for Rashomon, obviously.
Same with 400 Blows, Touch of Evil. For me, I can't stop thinking of those films. They've sunk into my soul. This watching them this time, like
for sure.
Ollie,
all right. So my number 10 is Man in the White Suit. Perfectly enjoyable, fine film. Nothing wrong with it, but it just didn't blow me away. Then we've got Them, which again just perfectly fun B movie. Like, you know, it's a perfect B movie, but it's still a B movie nonetheless.
For sure.
Yeah, it's almost like a heightened B movie. Yeah. It is good. Like.
But I will say the acting in that is probably more naturalistic than a Searchers.
Probably. Probably.
Then I've got The Hitchhiker, which again I thought was great, but didn't really leave a lasting mark on me. I mean, you know, I haven't forgotten about it, but like, than the other films. But then I've got The Bad and the Beautiful. Then the next six, literally, you could probably almost, apart from probably the so top hard, one, you could probably rotate. Do you know what I mean? They're all pretty much 5-star films.
Yeah, for sure.
So yeah. I've gone for The Searchers, then The Seventh Seal, 400 Blows, Touch of Evil, Rafifi, and then number one, I've got Rashomon.
Beautiful.
Awesome. That's cool. That's so
what
cool.
What a fucking list of films.
What a list of films, yeah. What a list of films.
Jesus Christ. Yeah, those top six basically are just like film school in a bottle.
Oh, yeah.
They really are, yeah.
I mean, it's embarrassing that we hadn't already seen them, but we've seen them now, so at least we've seen them.
There's never anything bad about not seeing a film. At least you get to enjoy it.
Like, yeah, I mean, I'd never seen The Searchers before, and that's a massive blind spot. So
was that by choice or...?
No, I just hadn't gotten around to it. I did do like a mini John Wayne marathon many years ago. So I have seen The Quiet Man. I have seen Stagecoach. I did see Rio Bravo, I think. But for whatever reason, this one wasn't, I don't know, didn't make the cut at the time and never went back to it.
I got to say, there's a mix between stuff like, no one's ever told me to watch The 400 Blows or Touch of Evil before. Like Rashomon, Seventh Seal, Rafifi, they're films that people constantly are like, you know, watch these. But for some reason, like 400 Blows, Touch of Evil, there haven't been something in my life someone's been going, watch this, and I've ignored them. It's literally just not been something anyone suggested to me. So like,
that surprises me about 400 Blows, actually, because that is a very well loved film, even you know, across generations.
They're definitely something I've found out and looked into, so.
I'm just looking at our YouTube page and just looking at the views. Man in the White Suit has got 216 views, which is nuts compared to like some of them have just got like two, like 400 Blows has got 2 views. Like how is that possible? What's going on?
I think you guys clearly paid for a troll view farm on that one, on that particular episode.
I think sometimes you just hit a niche of people wanting to hear films talk about that aren't talked about. Sometimes you just manage to hit that niche.
Looking at this, it's definitely the B movie ones that kind of like. Golden Voyage of Sinbad, Godzilla, and stuff like that are the ones that kind of people like. And Rashomon's got quite a few views, actually.
Hell yeah, go Rashomon.
YouTube's quite funny. It's completely different to our downloads.
Like, well, it counts. You only have to listen to like 30 seconds of it, and it counts as a view, doesn't it? And then
someone's there watching 30 seconds of The Man in the White Suit. We were going to do a couple. I want to do a shout out of The Bad and the Beautiful had the best tagline of any film that we did.
Which is why.
It was, I took you out of the gutter, I can fling you back.
Oh man. That's oh yeah, best tagline. Best lines. Oh god, you'd be here all day.
I don't know. Top of my head, I don't know.
I watched Touch of Evil last night, so that had like two good ones. But after that, I can't remember.
Touch of Evil, so good. Touch of Evil. I almost want to rewatch it. I was going to give like best villain. I was thinking Orson Welles gets that for me.
Oh yeah,
even though Death is one of the
Death.
Yeah, but Death doesn't come across as a villain in that film at all.
No,
it's true.
Shout out again. I thought the villain in The Hitchhiker was really good.
He is. He's wonderful.
Like, he's like, quite scary.
Lazy eye and
yeah. And John Wayne in The Searchers, obviously.
What about the giant bugs? The giant ants? Come on.
They sucked.
Yeah, they're very iconic.
Okay. I wasn't particularly frightened about them.
I mean, if we were to include Night of the Hunter, clearly he would.
Oh yeah, yeah, obviously.
Get the number one spot.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's as good as it gets. I'm glad you guys included that, and you have a film that references it later in the 80s, I do believe.
Yeah, I haven't. I've been hiding that, but yeah.
Well, I was going to say that we watched it. I watched a film the other day that references it in it.
Oh, you did? Did you finally watch Do the Right Thing then?
No, Promising Young Woman.
Oh, does that reference it as well?
Well, no, it does, doesn't it? Yeah. They're just watching it on TV.
Oh, that's lame.
But there are obviously like some reasons why that film was used.
Night of the Hunter is like a filmmaker's film. Filmmakers love that fucking film.
It's easy to see why. God.
Yeah, definitely.
That is remarkable.
Yeah. So fun.
So that wraps up the 50s then?
It does. Yeah, we've sorted it out. No one else can ever speak about the topic.
No, it's done now. It's done. 50s yep. is done.
50s is
Everything
over.
Everything said about it is done.
Yep.
And I look forward to watching films in the 80s that might actually have black actors in it.
Any non-white actor? Well, there were Comanches. Well, hold on. There were actual Comanches in The Searchers. And there were Mexican actors in The Hitchhiker and I think in Touch of Evil in the background. I want to say, well, definitely in The Hitchhiker.
Yeah, they were definitely in Touch of Evil. But
and
not
that's the end of that.
That's it.
It was an extraordinarily white marathon and everybody's Japanese and Rashomon, so that's different.
Yeah, so, yeah, sure. That'd be weird if Rashomon was a white actor.
That'd be hilarious.
So what's our first film we're tackling then? In the 80s.
The first film we're tackling is we're going to Britain, where we're quite familiar with Britain. and we're doing a Ken Russell film. And oh, Lord, I'm scared about what this film's going to be like.
Is this Altered Ken States? Russell's
yeah, I can't insane. Wait.
I cannot wait to watch this movie. This is a blind spot for me. Cannot fucking wait to watch this. I'm so excited.
It looks
if anyone didn't hear that, we're doing Altered States, and I think James is joining us for that one.
Oh,
yeah,
awesome! James
to join us, yeah.
Shout out to the other co-hosts, by the way, who are all better than me and should be here instead.
One day we'll have everyone on. That would be insane. Well, when we do the wrap up for the whole century.
ranking 100 to 1.
Yeah, yeah. The only Ken Russell movie I've seen is The Lair of the White Worm, which totally fucking rules.
It does rule, and it's. I recently put it on my letterbox list of archaeology films.
Oh yeah, okay. Legitimately, one of the sexiest performances in the history of cinema, with the witch worm lady, who's just is just in my nightmares and dreams at the same time now, and very looking forward to Altered States. Good choice.
It's going to be mad. Ken Russell is insane. It's just insane.
I mean, I'm excited to hear what James says.
Well, thanks for joining us, Brandon. Much appreciated.
My pleasure. As usual.
Right, again, thanks everyone for listening. And don't forget to please rate, review, and subscribe. I can't say subscribe. I can say it when I say it slow, but when I say it fast, subscribe.
Talk really slowly.
Right, thanks everyone for listening. And please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. I can't do it. Subscribe.
You know what? I need conviction here, Ollie.
Right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on whatever you listen to. I can't do it.
That's fucking trash.
I can say it normally.
Man. That
subscribe.
Was awful.
I can do it.
Oh, my God.
Let me do it.
I did so many letters.
Subscribe.
Subscribe.
Right. Right, thanks everyone for listening, and please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on whatever you listen to us on, be that Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, wherever you can find us, we're there. And please, again, you know, do the thing I just said. Don't forget, you can reach out to us on Twitter. We're at AdjustYourTrack. That's with a YR, not a your. And yeah, don't forget, if the pitch is bad, always adjust your tracking.